Welcome to Grub and Grace, where my family told me to quit telling Thanksgiving jokes, but I couldn't quit cold turkey. I am Mark Flower, and today we will be talking with my guest, Andrew Camp, the host of the Biggest Table podcast, about hospitality, cultural practices, and potential ways to navigate a difficult family dinner around the table. So, tag along as we dig in.
Welcome to Grub and Grace. I'm Mark Flower. I'm here with Andrew Camp. Andrew Camp is the host of the Biggest Table podcast. Draws on his experience as both a professional chef and a pastor to help people experience a rich lived experience around the table. He has a master's in spiritual formation and soul care from Talbot Seminary. He is married to Claire, has two daughters, Hazel and Hannah, and currently lives in Flagstaff, Arizona. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Mark. It's great to join you.
Yeah, and so it's really good to have you. I'm really looking forward to this. Like we were talking about before we started the recording, we both went to Theology Beer Camp just, what was it, two weeks ago now?
Yeah, two or three weeks ago. Yeah, it's so crazy. Yeah, time.
I know.
Time.
It feels so long ago now.
Right, yes.
But we didn't actually meet. We saw each other walking around, but we never actually... Like you were saying, there's like 600 people there, so it's really difficult to meet everybody. But I'm really glad that we connected afterwards.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah, no, and you know, it's always cool to connect with another podcaster who's exploring food and this idea of the table and stuff. So yeah, it's always fun.
And that's what's so excited about this episode that we're going to be recording is that we both have similar kind of, you know, we're parallel in our ideas and our subjects and our podcasts.
Yeah. No, and it's, yeah, the faith and food podcasts. I don't know how many there are. Yeah. I haven't done a deep dive research into it, but there aren't many. And so it's cool that it's always fun to connect with other people doing similar work and passions.
Mm-hmm. I am finding out that there are a few out there.
Yes.
I'm going to have to take note and send them over to you because I have taken note. There are a few. We're not alone on this.
No, we're not. No, for sure. There are a few. It's just hard to find them. And especially, like you said, this is a passion project. My podcast is a passion project. And so, you know, it's spare time that you devote to this. And so to try to figure it all out is hard sometimes.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And you got kids. I have one kid. So it's difficult to find that time in between to really, you know, make episodes, record, find people that you can, you know, have time with and that sort of thing.
Yep. Absolutely.
Is there anything else that you'd like to kind of share and about yourself or?
No. Yeah. I think it is, you know, this intersection of food and spirituality, faith for me has been a long journey. It started probably 15, 20 years ago. Always wanted to enter into it more fully, but just the timing never seemed right between jobs and kids and moving. But, in the past 18 months, you know, my life took a radical shift when I got laid off from a church job unexpectedly. And so wanting, you know, at the encouragement of my wife and thinking about what's next, you know, wanting to enter into this. And so it's just been cool to just explore this intersectionality of food and spirituality more fully and to have some rich conversations. And so, yeah, excited to further that conversation with you today.
Oh, for sure. No, thanks for sharing that. So today our topic is going to be, I aptly named it the Biggest Table just cause you know, we're a food podcast.
Right.
And, I sort of ripped off your name. I hope you're okay with that.
Totally okay with it. Yes.
Happily. Just for one episode.
No. Hey, it's the Biggest Table. All are welcome. You know, I have no trademarks, you know, however we can help people get to the table and, you know, or even just think about food in new, fresh ways, especially in light of everything. As we're in America, you know, as we think about America life right now, like I think just getting us to the table and trying to humanize each other, I think is so important. So however that happens, I don't care, you know? So
that's how we grow and build community, right?
Exactly.
So I do want to talk a little bit about how we do build community through this conversation, even entering the holiday season with Thanksgiving and Christmas coming up, that, you know, trying to figure out a way to navigate some of these conversations. you know, I sent you a couple of these questions. I'll go ahead and just kind of jump into the first one here.
Yeah.
So the first one was from 4 years of experience around food and the table, or from your experiences, sorry, not four, from your experiences, you've been here much longer. What is it about the table that encourages and fosters relationships and community to grow?
That's a great question, because it's like, I think in some sense, you know, and this, I don't say this as a cop-out answer, I think there is a mystery at the table that does happen, you know, and I don't know if we can always fully explain it, but I want to explain it because that's why, you know, we're doing what we're doing too. But I think it's this idea that when you're sitting face to face, you know, and you can make that time, you know, where you're not just scarfing down food. It's not a night where, hey, kids got to get to X, Y, and Z, or, you know, we're hurried. But if you can slow down enough, and I realize that's not every night. Some nights you just got to either feed yourself and feed your family, whatever life situation you're in. And so, but when we're able to slow down enough and have conversation and share the same food, there's this space created where you see somebody differently. You share stories, you share similar desires, you know, and hopefully you can dig down deeper into those shared values. So even if you're coming from very different perspectives, and I think that's the beauty of the table, is it can foster relationships across the spectrum of ideologies. You see each other for who they are. And I always come back to this quote from like Henry Nouwen from Reaching Out, where he talks about hospitality, where like the hospitality is making space for the other person to be who they truly are. You know, and so I think that table fosters that idea where we can just sit and, you know, hopefully take a deep breath, you know, enjoy a sip. If you drink alcohol, like enjoy a sip of wine, you know, and that the alcohol does help just sort of relax everybody a little bit.
Loosens like, you think, up a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and so I think there is, you know, do you need alcohol? No. But like, I think that does help. And then when you can just enjoy food and just see each other, not as an ideology, but as a person, the table does that. And that's what, like, you know, I was asking this question, you know, a long time ago. It was actually when I was living in China after college, and, you know, just noticed we were sitting at the table a lot. Like, what is it about the table? And it wasn't until I was reading a book by Eugene Peterson, you know, when he points out that the gospel writers are most fond of telling stories of Jesus around the table. You know, and so I'm like, okay, this is what Jesus did. And as soon as I saw that and read that, it's like, I saw the table and food everywhere. Like it was one of those like moments that like just shifted everything for me. But you just see the table as this means of communication of something more than just physical nourishment. Something is happening that God wants to do something in and through us at the table that can't be done otherwise. Like, and so that's where there's something profound and mysterious happening. But I think if we're intentional, we can cultivate that mystery. So it's just, the table is just a beautiful place, you know, and not for everybody. I realize that too. Like, I think through my podcast, I've realized there are broken stories and we do bring broken stories to the table. And so like my experience has always been one of joy and celebration and belonging. But I realize some people, whether it's through eating disorders, whether it's through racism, you know, the whole mix of the brokenness of life, you know, we do bring broken stories to the table too. And so I think being aware of those ideas as well has helped round out my theology of the table a little bit.
Oh, I love everything you put it. To add on and expand on it, like the way I see it, the food kind of takes the burden off the individual, where you're focused more on the food in front of you. Like you were talking about with alcohol, drink, or even just like you're eating like a chicken leg or something like that. Like you're focusing more on the food. Obviously, it's more of a core, you know, of us to have nourishment and sustenance in our life. So when we're able to take the focus off of trying to, you know, share our ideas, be right, we're focused more on the food and our ideas, and our conversation kind of flow naturally through that.
Yeah.
So it just kind of opens up that space and allows for an area to to foster that community building, that growth relationship with each other.
For sure. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's see, I'll go to the next one here. Through your experiences with people from different cultures, what positive traits about how others view and practice life around the table do you implement in how you view and practice life around it?
It's a hard question.
It's a really hard one.
You know, and what I've noticed too, you know, and I don't know about you, doing this podcast, I realized like, the ideologies sound great. This big ideas of the table, like, sound great. It's really hard to practice. Like, And so I don't do this well. Like I, you know, like you said, I'm a father of two girls, both my wife and I work, you know, and so it's hard, right? Like, you know, it'd be great if we were having people over at our home once a week or, you know, and just had this open door policy where people could come in if they needed to, or, it's harder to practice. You know, because it does just take one intentionality. It takes that space, that okay with mess. But, you know, when I saw that question, I thought back when my wife and I were living in outside the Park City, Utah area. I was working at a church there. And it's Park City is a very white, affluent culture. There is 20% of the population is Latino because of all the service industry folk. It's a resort town. And so there is a large Latino population. And for some reason that I can only say Jesus, like two Latino couples show up to this white church and say, no, this is where we're supposed to be. And you're like, okay. And eventually they're like, we want to start a Latino ministry. We want to reach out to the Latinos, like help us. And what made this possible for me as a gringo who speaks no Spanish is Claire, my wife, is fluent in Spanish. Mm-hmm. And so like we were able to communicate, converse, get to know these couples in profound ways. And so one year, this couple, Leonel and Mariam, they're from Colombia, arrived in America speaking no English. And we just naturally gravitated towards them. And they became dear friends. And Leonel's birthday, they invited us over for dinner, and we're the only white people. I'm the only non-Spanish speaker at this table. And yet we're sitting there and it's a great, rich experience, and people are translating and most of them speak, you know, English. So they're helping me understand, and I can understand Spanish more than I can speak it. But I just remember leaving there with like a full heart. Like, wow, there was something I felt like I belonged. I felt loved, even though it wasn't, you know, it was another person's birthday. Like, it was like, wow, like that was a rich experience, richer than sometimes with just Anglos, you know? And so they just created this sense of belonging. And I don't know how or what it was about that evening, you know? And so I can't pinpoint it, you know, and that's how, you know, but that story always comes back to me because I'm like, okay, there were, even in the midst of language and cultural barriers, there was something happening at that table that allowed me as an outsider to feel welcome. You know, it says probably more about Leonel and Mariam's heart and who they are as people and their love. Like, you know, as since we're talking about food, like whenever I would go to a conference or had to travel for work, they would always bring Claire dinner. Like, hey, we'll take care of Claire for you, Andrew. Don't worry about it. And like, probably the least wealthy people that I'm, you know, in our congregation are, you know, going out of their way to help my wife, you know, whereas a lot of the other people had way more means, material means. But yet, like, they just, hospitality was just core to who they were, you know, and so I don't know if I'm answering your question. That's
No. I think you are. I think there's a lot of different aspects to what you were talking about, and especially that last little point of how, you know, individuals and families that have less wealth than others. You see Jesus talk about this quite a bit in the Bible, where you know, it's easier for a rich man to, or easier for a poor person to go through. You're getting to heaven than a rich man to get, you know, the eye of a needle or something like thread through. Yeah. I forget how the verse goes, but I probably just butchered that completely.
No, yeah.
Tons of comments of what the actual verse is. But yeah, he talks about this quite a bit, you know, critiquing a lot of the wealthy, like aristocrats of that day, the Pharisees, the you know, coin collectors, and he's very critiqueful on that. But then he talks a lot about, you know, the less wealthy, the oppressed, the needy, those in need. And you see that a lot in the culture even today, is like you were talking about, where those who don't have as much wealth and opulence, they are very giving with mm-hmm. everything, with a lot of what they have. Whereas when you have people that have a lot of wealth, you don't, I mean, they it's almost like they want to be helpful, they want to be giving, and they do a little bit, but in right. contrast to everything they've got, they're very, actually very stingy about everything. And it's not everybody that's like that, but you see that quite often. And I feel like that even myself, like I feel like as a white man, I've got a lot of privilege, and, right. And I've probably got more wealth than majority of the Americans. And I feel like, how can I do this? And how am I doing it wrong? Where am I falling short? And I feel like I fall short quite frequently.
Yeah. No, yeah, and that's, as I think about the richest experiences of hospitality, it's, you know, the things that stand out are these one-off experiences that you just are profound, you know, and that stay with you from people you least expected it from, you know. And we did meet some, like you said, there were some very generous, wealthy people in the world, and we met those people in Park City, and they blessed us, and they gave us some experiences that we'll never have again, right? But that sense of deep belonging and relationality that happens with you know, with this couple, Lionel and Mariam, like, it was just so beautiful, you know. And whether that's the Latino way, you know, that culture brings out more of it versus our American way that is less hospitable, you know, I think. We could learn a lot from cultures from hospitality and what, you know, what they can teach us.
Yeah. I feel like you're speaking a lot so I just recently listened to your episode with Dave and, Jane, Colley, about hospitality. And I, a lot of what you're saying is what, you know, what they were saying. And it was just such a nice listen. And, especially with like learning from other cultures. I also really like your episode with Grace Jisun Kim.
Yeah.
She, so I love her stuff. I read her book right before Theology Beer Camp, and, I can relate a lot. So my wife is Korean. She, she's told me quite a bit about her upbringing and story, but I feel like reading Grace Jisun Kim's book, the When God Became White, it felt like I was kind of relearning my wife's story in a different perspective. It was similar, but different.
Right.
In Southeast Asia, when we're visiting, they would tell us that they have a saying, same, same, but different.
Yes.
And that's exactly how it felt. It felt very, serendipitous, and just kind of like, it felt like I was hearing my wife's story again, retold. Mm. And so I could really relate to it, and just hearing a lot about, how she, her upbringing, the racism with that, but also just kind of like, it reminded me like my time in Korea. So I actually lived in South Korea for a little bit.
Nice.
And, I was able to spend time with, the local people there, through our church, in our area, and or the local church. So we got to know quite a bit of the people in our area, and, even just spending time with my wife's family. Like we have there's a saying right before you sit down for a meal, everyone sits down, all the food's on the table, and you say, "Jambogosamida," which means thank you for the food. And so, it's just kind of one of those practices that we don't normally always use at home here, but whenever we're with family, somebody always yells it out, you know, "Jambogosamida."
That's cool.
Everyone's like, "Oh, Jambogosamida." It's like learning from these other cultures and how they do life.
Well, even, you know, when I was in China, like the greeting, you know, the everyday greeting, when you see somebody, and especially somebody you have a relationship with, is "Chirfandama," which means, "Have you eaten yet?"
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, and so like eating and this greeting were one and the same, you know. And, you know, I'd be curious to do when did that phrase become an idiom in Chinese mm-hmm. culture? And, you know, just because of their history, the oppression and the lack sometimes, you see in China, like, was this part of just making sure you're watching out for each other? But, it's always something like, the natural greeting when you say hi to somebody is like, Chirfandama, have you eaten yet? Like, mm-hmm. Which is just a unique way of looking at each other in life.
Mm-hmm. No, it's Korean is very similar too. So they, after they say annyeong, they say also hello, they'll say like, mogeyo, mok is like food. So, like eat. Yeah. So like, have you eaten? Okay. And so yo is like the formal way of saying it. But yeah, they have a very similar thing with that too.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. That's cool.
I was going to share something about Gracie Jason Kim, your conversation with her. Oh yeah. So, your conversation with Gracie Jason Kim, she was talking about, how Western cultures do meals. So they typically have to, they ask like, how many people are you going to have over so I can prepare enough food? But Eastern cultures, what you specifically talk about with Korean, is that people sit around the table and they're not really trying to gauge how many people are coming, but like they just kind of welcome whoever wants to come. So they just anticipate that more family's going to come. Mm-hmm. That's my experience with that too. And I wanted to share about the table. So she talked about the little table. So everyone just kind of crunches around like a little table. So this table is literally just like a foot and a half off the ground. Right. And it's just this big square table or big rectangle table. My experience was that it is very difficult because I'm a little bit taller. I'm maybe just around 6 feet.
Okay.
And so my legs are a little bit longer. So trying to go cross-legged or sit at this table, after about like 15 minutes, my legs start cramping up.
Yep.
It's been a very unique and good learning experience as to how other cultures do things. Cause I'm so used to sitting in a chair, but then right. having to sit like on the floor cross-legged, been very eye-opening as far as like, there's not one way of doing things. There's many ways of doing things. And she was even talking about even the utensils. I find chopsticks to be a very superior way of eating food, I guess you could say.
Yes.
Like, I love it. I love using chopsticks.
Yeah.
And you just don't see that too much in like Western cultures here.
No. Although I found, I got to travel to Korea when I was living in China just a few times. But like I found Koreans used more metal chopsticks. And I found those way more difficult to use than the wooden chopsticks,
they like take a little time to get used to.
Yeah. Like you know that you have a little more friction with the wood, and so the metal chopsticks always, it took a little more, dexterity.
As things slip off of it a lot more.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it was great. I love Korean food.
Oh yeah. It's so good. Chinese food is good too. I mean, Indian food, I don't know if I could pick any one food to be my favorite food. I think I'm a little biased saying Korean food is probably my favorite one. I just love it so much, but there's so many good foods around the world.
There are.
So let's jump into the holidays. So I kind of wanted to touch on this just because we are approaching it and there's going to be a lot of people that are very stressed about the holiday season with family and friends. So major holidays such as Thanksgiving and Christmas bring family and friends around the table with a variety of ideologies and opinions. How does this potentially go against the idea of the table bringing people together, while causing like strife and separation? And what do you see as some good tips to navigate different conversations so we can get back to the table being a place of healing and reconciliation?
Hmm. Yeah. Right.
It's a loaded question.
No, it is right. And, but let's own it. Let's own the discomfort, right? Like, I think not naming it just hides it, right? Like, my whole family's going to be together at Thanksgiving for the first time. Like, the last time we all were together for a holiday was Christmas of, I think it was 2017. We've been together since then, but for a holiday, So yeah, it's a rare thing, it's 7 years and we get along, and so I don't expect much strife and enmity with us, and watch, something's going to blow up. But, I think at least owning it and saying, okay, we're going, some of your listeners, for these listeners who are traveling back to their family, like they may not know what to expect and they're holding their breath and their body's probably just tensing up thinking about it. So I think owning it, like, let's just own it. name it, you know, and we're not in a cultural period that you could say, you know, brings peace. You know, I think we just got through the election, you know, and there's a lot of still tense feelings and a lot of feels that are happening, for good or for bad, right? Like, you know, and those tables are going to be mixed with those people. And so I think naming it and like, you know, if your listeners, for your listeners who are dreading going to the back to their family or, you know, unsure, you know, or realizing they're carrying some tension, I think finding somebody they can just talk to about it beforehand, you know, can you find somebody safe that can, hey, like, I'm going into this space, I don't know what to expect, like, I'm carrying some tension, you know, whether it's just a close friend that you trust or a therapist or a spiritual director, like, is there somebody you can trust to at least talk with it before you go and not carry it alone? Because I think that's the worst. Like, if you're expecting something and you're carrying it without ever voicing it, like, your body's just going to internalize it. Like, you know, so much work has been done on trauma, right? Like, and I'm not a trauma expert, but by any stretch, but just know, like, the stress we carry in our bodies is going to manifest itself somehow. So I think the more we can at least own it and talk about it beforehand will be vital. But then also, like, I got to sit down on my podcast and talk with Caleb Campbell, he's a pastor down in Phoenix. And Phoenix politics is not always good, right? Like, There is a lot in Phoenix that is, you know, Christian nationalism is rampant. Like, you know, Charlie Kirk and his Turning Point are like right there, like Dream City, you know, like there's a hotbed of activity happening there. And Caleb has seen it and experienced it and been like, to listen to his story and the stress he was under during COVID is just brutal, right? But he's also come through it with the help of, you know, doctors, and his board stood by him to be able to be like, okay, so how does he engage? And I think, you know, in his book is on how do we love our Christian nationalist neighbors? Like, instead of demonizing them, how do we actually engage them in a loving way that Jesus would do the same, which is profound in its own right. But I think what he came back to, and I think the principles he talks about in his book, Disarming Leviathan, carry forward to any person that's tough to love. But what's always stuck with me about his work and, you know, the conversation is he said 98% of the work begins with me. You know, and so like, can I be secure enough in who I am to engage, where I'm not automatically triggered and want to lash out, but can I be secure enough in me and be in a steady, grounded space where that way when I do engage, I'm not returning fire with fire, but rather, you know, returning their combativeness with compassion. And so I think too, just so that's where I think starting with these conversations with people, with trusted friends and confidants before we go, like, is so important, because we need somebody to hold us too. Like, you know, and then go and do your best to engage. And find the common ground. Like, I think as much as it's hard to recognize, I think there is a lot of us that want we share core values of what we want. Like, we all want safety. We all want freedom. You know, we want, you know, people to flourish. I think how that manifests itself is different, you know, and don't get me wrong. Again, there are some very bad ideas, wrong ideas that are racist, like homophobic, right? Like, that is never what I'm, you know, talking about. But to try to find some common ground too, you know, and do the hard work and to be a bigger person, which I hate, like, right? Like, you know, I want to be the small person and be petty and, you know.
So again, yeah. It's easier to do that, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is, right? Like, it's so much harder to be the bigger person. But like, if we want the table and we want this table to bring back the flourishing of all people, like, somebody's going to have to be the bigger person. Mm-hmm. And that's like, okay, like we have to wrestle with that. Is that going to be me, or am I okay? You know, whether, you know, your family's going to have this hostile, like yelling match of politics and religion, or whether it's just going to, everything's just not going to be talked about. And we're just going to talk about the weather. Like, can I bring something more that might bring us closer together? Because, you know, talking about the weather, talking about sports, that's fine, but that's not the table, you know, and that's not what we want at the table. And so I think how to do it, it is hard, and it does take a lot of self-work to do.
No, I actually really like the aspect that you talked about, finding someone safe that you can talk to about beforehand. It kind of makes me think of like when you're preparing for like a speech or something like that in front of many people, you don't just go on the stage and just wing it. You practice it.
Yeah.
So when you're talking to somebody, you're able to, it's almost like going to a therapist. You're able to let out some of this pent up, emotion that you have about what's going to be, you know, happening in the future. So that way you can kind of prepare yourself, release yourself, and allow yourself for an open space to take on whatever comes. That way you're a little bit more calm-headed and relaxed about what happens. It's not saying that you are going to be relaxed.
No,
you
know, right.
These conversations are never easy, but it allows you to release some of that so that you're not like a shaken, you know, soda pop can ready to explode once you open it. It's you can release a little bit that, you know, when you kind of do a little
yep.
And you release some of that, it just helps with you know, engaging with some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to practice, like you said, like, I don't know how you practice beforehand, you know, but, you know, and to be okay, to give yourself grace too with it. Like, okay, like I messed up there, you know, but it does take practice, you know, and again, Caleb Campbell's work, like he has like scripts in the back of his book of like mm-hmm. ways to like think through of like, okay, if person X says this, here's how you could respond. You know, and again, like you said, you don't go into a speech just winging it. But there's thoughtfulness and like, okay, like if they say this, then, you know, here's a way I could respond. You know,
and almost so like playing the devil's advocate in a way, like have yeah. that same person kind of play the other person. That's perfect. I love that.
Yeah. So yeah, I think there are ways to do it. But again, I think, am I willing, you know, and it starts with me, right? Like, am I willing to be the bigger person, and have conversations that will be sticky and hard, but might lead to deeper connection, you know, versus sweeping everything under the rug and just pretending we're fine. Mm-hmm. When nobody's fine, right? Like, like, can we just be honest? Like nobody's saying in this cultural moment, like, you know what? Yeah, this is a great moment. Like we're right where we need to be. And so I think if nobody's happy, like, can we try something like, mm-hmm. You know, and do it and have a place to process it. And if not the table, and if not with friends and family, like then who?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's one of the things I've always been kind of struggling with. One of the things is knowing that I might not know everything. And being yeah. fine with that. So, right. So you might be wrong about it. Something. So your ideas yeah. of how to do politics or how to live life or you know, everything that comes along with all of those is that you might be wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's where having conversations with differing opinions really comes in because it, you know, it shapes you and your opinion and gives you more of a full picture. Yeah. I think it was Neil deGrasse Tyson that said, there's a fine line between, knowing just enough to think that you're right, but not enough to know that you're wrong. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to know those boundaries until you start having conversations with people that are different than you.
Right.
So having these conversations are important. But yeah, that's the question is how do we navigate these issues and everything? And, I mean, what I've been trying to do and what I'm still learning with my family too, around some of these topics, is how to show grace and to listen. I think listening is such an important tool that we've almost forgotten how to use. A lot of people have, and I'm trying to constantly remind myself, okay, I need to hear them out and allow them space to express their opinions. And then after them, I can take a breath and I can, you know, instead of coming back with, this is how you're wrong, I start asking questions. And it almost starts to disarm in a way. So that way it opens up for a more broader conversation. And if it goes south, that happens. But right. At least it gives you an opportunity and a chance to have those conversations.
Yeah. No, and maybe it is, you know, setting those ground rules too. Like, you know, making sure like, hey, we're not going to name call. but I like what you pointed out that like, I could be wrong about a lot of things. And like, can I approach a conversation with what could this other person teach me? What could I learn from this person? And to have that humility and space to listen, I think it is the way forward.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. So I'll move on to this last question here, and then I'm going to spring your own questions on you after that. Yeah. So my last one was, if there was one thing you could change and improve about how you do life around the table, what would that be?
I think more diversity. Mm-hmm. It's easy to practice hospitality. Like we've already talked, it's easy to practice hospitality with like-minded people. You know, it's easy to have my friends over and just have fun and think, well, I'm a hospitable person, but am I inviting more diversity to my table? Like, I don't like conflict. And so like, I don't, you know, I'll sweep everything under the rug and just keep everything surface level, you know? So yeah, I think more diversity, even, you know, just yesterday as I reflected on the election and took a moment to, sense what I was feeling. And I think for me, what came out, you know, as a white middle-class heterosexual male, like the chances of Trump's presidency affecting me feel small. Like, and I could be naive, right? Like, you know, I don't know. But I also know like I'm not the demographic he has spewed hatred towards. Whereas those people who he has spewed hatred towards are afraid and have anxiety, stress, fears about what the next 4 years hold. And could I move towards the fringes and listen to those people, knowing like Jesus is most often found on the fringe and not at the center of power by any stretch of the means. So I think for me, it really is like, I wish, you know, we just had space, you know, and maybe if we make it right, like, you know, you got to be intentional, but, yeah, I do wish there was more diversity at my table.
Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the most important things we can do is, and I know some of my listeners might think, oh, when you say diversity, like, oh, get more people that aren't American, you know, get, people from right. Mexico, get people from South Korea, get people from, you know, Australia or wherever. But no, it's diversity. Yeah, that, but diversity in ideas as well.
Right.
Diversity in even just different cultures within the outside of your bubble. Mm-hmm. So it could still be in America, but it just could be, you know, like I live in Colorado. It could be someone in Florida. There's vastly different cultures that happen, in those two areas, even just, you know, those kind of, yeah. diversity, cultural diversity too. So, yeah, trying to make that point, I think, is so important. It illuminates a lot of things that you're doing right or wrong, and a lot of the stuff in the middle too, where you can maybe find common ground.
For sure. Yeah.
All right. So here comes. I'm sure you've thought about this before. Someone may have asked you on your own show too, but I haven't gotten through enough episodes to hear your answers. But
nobody's asked me yet. I've been able to
really?
Elude, and I've been on a few other podcasts where they're like, "Hey, if we have time, I'm going to turn the questions to you." You know, so you're the first to actually follow through.
Yes.
With it. So I appreciate it. Yes.
Okay, and if you want to ask me too, I can answer mine. But yeah. Okay, so what's one food that you refuse to eat?
Okay, so when I was in China, we were this, I forget what trip this was. I think it was on a summer trip or something. And we went and we were in a village, and they served us chicken kidneys, stewed chicken kidneys. And they, like, you bit into them and then they exploded in your mouth and they were mushy and like at the time, and this is where I'm going to correct myself, they were repulsive to me. Like, and it took me a while then to eat cherry tomatoes because of that, like, exploding sensation, you know, that, mm-hmm. But I recently listened, to a book called Invitation to a Banquet. And I can never pronounce her first name, but her last name is Dunlop, but she's a British who studied Chinese culture and Chinese food and has become one of the world experts on Chinese food. But her book Invitation to a Banquet sort of talks all about Chinese cuisine. And it's a brilliant book because it actually illuminates the diversity and rich history and like the racism associated with Chinese. But what she talks about is that, like, you know, this village was actually showing us immense hospitality by giving us chicken kidneys, because like there's only a certain, like, you have to get a lot of chickens to get a full plate of chicken kidneys. And so serving these off the offals, the OFFAL, you know, it's the, if your listeners aren't familiar, it's the word used for sort of these lesser known parts, you know, sometimes like the livers, the intestines, you know, so, but to serve us these chicken kidneys required actually was showing us a sign of honor. And so like to wrestle with it that way, like it actually like helped me reframe the experience. Like, and this was 20 years ago, you know, to realize, oh, like this was actually a sign of love. And so while I still don't, it's not something I'm going to seek out, I appreciate it now in a different way, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I guess my non-go-to is, lutefisk. I don't know if you've heard of lutefisk before.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So my mom, she likes to put a lot of Norwegian type stuff and Northern European, right. Swedish and everything like that. So she likes to pull out the pickled herring during holidays and my dad refuses to eat it, but, I don't mind pickled herring, but lutefisk, I don't know if you know the process of lutefisk is, no. They use lye. So if you know what lye is, it's a cleaning agent. It's very toxic to humans. So out of principle, I know it's healthy to eat once it's all done, you know, fermenting in this lye and the process, making it mushy. And it's just like this mushy gelatinous thing. I don't mind that quite as much. I will eat pretty much anything. I've eaten tarantulas. I've eaten fish eyes, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
But lutefisk, it's merely out of the principle of how they make it with that cleaning agent that I will not eat it.
That's fair. Yes. I don't think I've ever had gefilte fish or lutefisk or, you know, those pickled fish, Norwegian styles yet. So,
but the thing you talked about in China, it reminds me of sea squirts. So I don't know if you've ever had sea squirts, but they kind of pop in your mouth and the flavor I just don't like. So if there's one food that I wouldn't go back to, I think it's that one.
Yeah.
What's one of the best foods that you've eaten?
So it always comes to two for me, and they're two very different experiences, but they were both shared with my good friend, Tai Hode. And so the first is there was this peach donut from the Donut Man in Glendora, California. The Donut Man is like, he's nation famous. Like he gets constantly ranked as one of the top 10 donut places in the U.S. But he's on Route 6, the original shop's on Route 66. But it's just this little walk-up stand. But during, you know, strawberry and peach season, they'll just get a glazed donut, slice it in half and stuff it full of either fresh strawberries or fresh peaches. And when I was in culinary school, like our culinary professors talked about it. And so I said, hey, Ty, we got to make the journey. We got to do this. And so one Saturday morning, he and I drove up there. And this was before I knew Claire, you know, and we each get a peach donut and we sit on this grassy patch, you know, and that's right on Route 66. And we sit down and we grab it and we each take a bite and we look at each other and like we laugh and we cry. Like something like... And I've had the peach donut since, and it's never been that like response. And there's very few things, but like we each took a bite and we're like, what have we just tasted? And why has it taken us this long to taste a peach donut? Like it sounds so silly, but it's just one of those moments where you're like, this works and it's beautiful and it's great. And it's a peach donut from a donut stand on Route 66. So that's like one of the best food memories I've had. The second comes close is when I was dating Claire, my parents for my birthday gave me money to go to a restaurant that one of my chef mentors had was running at the time, Marché. And I had talked to him beforehand. I said, hey, you know, and Ty, my good friend Ty and his wife, Heather, came along. So the four of us went and I said, hey, this is how much money I have. Like, just feed us and, you know, just make it whatever, right? You know, and he took extreme good care of us and just started giving us food, a bond food. And the special that evening was fresh white truffle risotto. And, you know, and it's like $85 a plate. And he each gives us each like a small sampling. He gives us like 10 courses over the night. In the middle of the dinner is this white truffle risotto. And I'm sitting there thinking all of a sudden, like, did he think we had like $200 per person? Like, what's going on? Like, you know, but we're eating this, you know, and it's just a rich experience of food and flavor. And like, but that white truffle risotto just was otherworldly. And at the end, the bill was exactly $200. And it was a gift of love from my chef, Gary.
Oh, that's so great.
But yeah, that white truffle risotto, you know, again, super simple, but like the depth of flavor and just the beauty of that dish.
Oh man, that sounds so good. All the foods, the peach donut, the truffle risotto, anything truffle is going to be amazing.
Right. Yes. And fresh truffles, not truffle oil. Like truffle oil is all chemically processed. Like if you like truffle oil, that's fine. But just know like there's actually no real truffle ever in truffle oil because the flavor of truffles aren't soluble in oil. And so like you have to use chemicals to recreate it. So
Interesting. I actually didn't know about that.
Yeah.
All right. So let's see if I can get this, how you do it on your show.
Yeah.
There's a conversation among chefs about last meals as if you knew you had one last meal to enjoy, what would that be? And so if you knew, oh no, I put that again twice. So if you knew, what would that be?
I've always said and thought like, I just want a world-class chef to just feed me and my friends. You know, I just want to sit at a table and have just food brought to us and different flavors and tastes and just let a really good chef create something special, like just truly feast. And it's always a joy. Like if we can do it, like if Claire and I go out and we can just tell the chef like, hey, just feed us, like create a tasting menu. And like, we don't need to see a menu, like just do what you want to do. Like you get to see the chef at their best. And so I think for my last meal, I would want just a feast for the ages with good wine and good people around it and just small bites, you know, so that way we could just eat for hours.
Man, that sounds good. That sounds really good. And I think I would love that too. There's just something about letting someone pick the menu for you and allow them to serve you. It's just something amazing about that. And also to do it with friends. And I think it was on that episode about hospitality that they said something like that, that it doesn't matter what food, it could be chicken nuggets or something like that, but it's more about the people around you.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. I always say like the food matters, but it doesn't. Because I think you can have a rich conversation with chicken nuggets and Kraft mac and cheese. But there is also a space and a time for the white truffle risotto.
You got to have the white truffle risottos.
Yeah. And to lavish, you know, and like that space to lavish with people and to show bounty and beauty.
Right on. Well, I don't want to keep you too long. I know, you know, you got snow and the kids at school and everything like that. So, but Andrew, it's been so great to talk to you. This conversation, I would love doing this again too. Absolutely. If you ever want to, just, you know how to hit me up and, we'll have to talk again soon about some of this. Cause I just love some of the stuff that you talked about as far as, food around the table and, bringing community together and reconciliation and everything. So, it's been a real pleasure, Andrew. I hope we do this again.
Yeah. No, thanks for having me, Mark. Again, hopefully next beer camp we can actually sit down and share a real beer in person together. And see where all of this has led us.
Let's do that. I look forward to it.
Awesome.
That's it for today's episode of Grub and Grace. I hope you enjoyed our discussion with Andrew Camp about the biggest table. You can find Andrew on his podcast, The Biggest Table, anywhere podcasts are found. Episode music is by Fleece Mob with the song Everything You Need. Graphics and visuals are by Root and Branch Creative. Remember to visit our website at grubandgrace.com. It's grubandgrace.com, as well as our socials on Facebook, Instagram, and X. Until next time, stay curious, keep an open mind, and celebrate the traditions that bring us all together.